got Dr. Thuraya Kanafani here. She's a clinical psychologist based at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. Anything you want to ask Thuraya today when it comes to your personal situation, if you're struggling a little bit emotionally, when it comes to depression and anxiety, these are all areas Dr. Thuraya can help you with, and of course in relationships too. Now, we are talking about millennials today, so that age group, age 18 to 33, off the back of this article out from the Huffington Post. The lost generation is what it's being called, and stating that more than ever before, this generation suffers more from depression, stress, and even suicide. So it needs to be talked about, it needs to be addressed, and that's why we're here today. So hello and welcome, Dr. Thuraya.
Good morning, Suzanne.
Good to have you back.
Thanks, it's good to be back.
And looking at this article, we're going to get into it, what's causing this lost generation. But that term, lost generation, where does that come from? What does it really mean?
Well, it comes from the idea that this Generation Y, which, you know, research shows that there are no precise dates. It's typically between, you know, born after the 1980s and sort of the birth date sort of stops between the mid-1990s and the early 2000s. So it's sort of like the 20 to 35-year-olds now. So the reason why they're called the lost generation is really because during this time, there had been so many changes in the environment, as well as changes in awareness and mental health and so many other things, that this generation has been lost between what was and what is now. And because the generations that came before that also have to do with, you know, they were not exposed to many of the changes that we have now, for instance, technological changes. So if you look at Generation Xers that came before the 1980s, they did not have the massive technological advancement that we have now. So everybody that came after the 1980s experienced that, but had no manual to experience it. So it was so the lost generation refers to a generation that has been exposed to so many different changes without the proper tools to change with it.
Mm, and cope, those coping mechanisms. And what we're looking at is things, the challenges that they're facing, things like how they've been parented, and also job prospects, high expectations placed upon them in academia. They're some of the things that could put added pressure on that generation. But it's not the first time a generation has been called lost. The lost generation, a term thought to be coined by Gertrude Stein, was the generation that came of age during World War I and referred to young people with prospects in life that looked dim. The term was also used to refer to the generation of unemployed youth in the Great Depression. If that term can be applicable to today's Generation Y, it's in reference to their high aspirations, yet what some would say are their dismal economic prospects. Now, is that something you agree with? I mean, do you have kids that are, you know, late teens into their early 30s? You yourself, that age group, do you think that prospects are dim? Do you believe that it's a tougher time to be that age? Let me know your thoughts on 4001. But yeah, so it's challenges. Gen Y has a very different set of values for work and life in general compared to the baby boomers. And there's many reasons for that. It's interesting you say about technology. Obviously, we're going through the technological revolution, and that generation, you know, born out of the 1980s into the 90s, have grown up with technology. But some will say that in generations before, huge changes happened. For the 1960s and 70s, it was, you know, in the UK, America, in the West, you know, huge changes happening in for women and for, you know, social circumstances, economically as well. Lots of changes have happened over the generations. So what is life like for the millennial living today? What's it like? How is it? What are the challenges? What are the good things about being a millennial? So get involved in the conversation and let me know what you think. And something that keeps coming up time and time again, and we've talked about it before, is, you know, working. So, you know, how you parent, would you allow your child to have a part-time job? Or, you know, what age do you have your first paid job? And that's something that's coming up that may or may not be good for kids if they're not getting that experience. So now, Thuraya, are you a millennial? You must be a millennial.
So according to this, I am considered a millennial. But to be honest, when I did a lot of research about the Generation Y, or for some people, they call them the Generation Whiny.
Or the Generation Me.
Right, the Generation Me. I couldn't actually identify identify with many of the things that they were talking about. And when I read through it, I said to myself, you know, when I really look at the 15 years or even almost 20 years worth of that generation gap, I think that generation could also be split into many generations within itself, because so many changes happen. I mean, I do appreciate a lot of the things that people are talking about when they talk about Generation Y, you know, especially with the technological changes and the addiction to social media and you know, being very sort of self-involved and not having proper work ethics. But I think it's really hard to unify that one identity as Generation Y, considering there are so many differences culturally, background, ethics, I mean, parenting styles, as well as, you know, such a massive technological change within those 20 years.
And yet, all the research is showing that there are higher rates of depression and suffering from stress in that generation that we call the millennial. So why is that? That's what we're going to be exploring today, and hopefully helping and shedding some light on this. I've learned a lot this morning, I have to say, going through some of the research. Looking here, the Pew Research Center's new survey, Young, Underemployed and Optimistic. And this gives you a great insight into Gen Y's situation. And the reporter showed, among other things, that 25 to 29 year olds, 34% of them have moved back home with their parents. And only 12% of whites between 18 to 34 believe owning a home is one of the most important things in life. Now, this is coming out of the United States. So all of those things add up, don't they? How you view the world, what your value system is, what opportunities you've got, and living the life that you want, that you're hoping for. They're all things that will contribute to your level of happiness, satisfaction, and even might affect your mental health. Looking at that millennial generation, the sort of 20 to 35s, I mean, it's sort of when, you know, there's a little leeway either side, but basically off the back of research suggesting that there's more reported cases of depression in this generation than generations before. So why is that? That's what we're exploring today. There are many things we're going to be looking at. You know, the idea of, I mean, you may have seen the movie with Matthew McConaughey, you know, Failure to Launch, where you've got a man there in his 30s still living at home with his parents because it's really good. He's getting his meals. He's got a lovely place to live. He can go out and play, do what he likes, and there'll always be his laundry done for him and, you know, dinner on the table. Why would he leave? Why would he move out? There's other things to consider as well, which I think the generations are facing is the economical situation. So being able to buy your own place, how accessible is that for the millennials? That's what we're looking at as well. And that idea of parents being best friends. Now, it should be a good thing. And one of the researchers I was looking at, one of the articles was saying that actually this generation are closer to their parents than ever before. Now, that should be a good thing. And it is a good thing. You know, they are more open, they're more able to talk to their parents, the parents are involved, they know what's going on in their kids' lives. That's been brought about through how times evolved, but also through technology, much more connected. But then I'm reading things like, now there are parents that are going to job interviews with their 22-year-old because that's the relationship they have. And is that all right? Is that a good thing? Soraya, picking up again, you know, on that sort of generation and the sort of grey area. I just want to add this in a little bit before we go back into that. Looking at this, the University of Michigan study of over 13,000 college students in the US, they were looking at this and compared college students in the late 1970s, saying that 40% are lower in empathy then, and so actually higher in empathy today. So there's some good news as well. The researchers examined 72 studies of students with a mean age of 20 from 1979 to 2000, all of whom had taken the Davis Interpersonal Reactivity Index test, which looks at empathy and concern and emotional response to distress to others and perspective, taking all of this into account, being in the other person's shoes. So it's not all about me. I have empathy. I am able to imagine what it must feel like for you. And those studies were coming up as being quite positive for our millennials today. today.
The biggest stereotype with the Generation Y is that, you know, they're accused of being lazy, selfish, self-involved, very narcissistic, self-absorbed, so they don't really care about others. But actually what they show is that, you know, research shows that Generation Y are creative, they're flexible. They actually have a stronger sense of social responsibility than ever before. They have a stronger care for the environment and for human rights and humanity. So they actually have a lot more empathy, like you have mentioned, than ever before, because they start to consider more people. And I think a little bit of that has to go back into the fact that, you know, when you consider globalization and how mixed all of our cultures are now, and especially over the last 20 to 30 years, that empathy grows from being exposed to different things and being aware of different cultures and personalities and religions and everything around you. And so that has been one of the greatest points and positive points of the Generation Y.
So I suppose it's also about how closeted you are, how much hand-holding goes on, and whether you can let your child go earlier than perhaps they are today. I don't know. What do you think? It's difficult for any parent. They want to do what they can for them always. But, you know, when you're looking at things like a part-time job, you know, when you're looking at traveling, you know, backpacking. When I was young, it was like quite common to hitchhike. I'm not suggesting we do that, because obviously people are concerned about security, but it was going on, you know, independence. I was at university, I would get myself there, you know, after the holidays. You'd have to, you know, get on public transport and get yourself on a train or a bus to get back to university. In holiday times, I went traveling, you know, friends of mine were traveling around India at age 19, 20, you know, so doing the backpacking thing but you saved your own money up to do it. Our parents weren't paying for us to go and do that and get that experience, which we're seeing more today with the kind of gap year concept. And again, you know, there's pluses and minuses on both sides. It's just exploring the differences and understanding why. I just want to get to the bottom of why is it that there are higher rates of depression. So is it about this sense of not having as much independence and having resources, inner resources, to figure stuff out and be more resilient? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, actually, you know, after World War II, when people started to really see how veterans came back and were so affected by the war, a lot of awareness for mental health started to come out. And so that generation, that technically raised Generation Y, started to really worry about people's stress and their feelings and their emotions, and how if they're feeling negative things. So they wanted to make sure that they didn't have those feelings. But the problem is that you have to have negative feelings in order to actually build proper coping strategies and learn to be independent and build your character. And so what ended up happening is, and you can see this till this day, I mean, a lot of parents will shelter their kids from feeling any kind of negative emotions. As soon as they get a little bit frustrated, they run and they give them something in order to like distract them or make them feel better. You know, if they cry a bit, it's like, no, I have to go and coddle them. And the idea is, no, let them feel it, because they have to learn how to build those resiliency skills in order to deal with what life is going to throw at them, which is both positive and negative.
So did you have a part-time job?
I did. Yeah. Actually, my part-time job was washing my father's car. Uh-huh. And I was never allowed, if I touched it afterwards and there was any kind of mark on it, I had to wash it all over again. So I washed my dad's car. I helped around the house. I made sure to like clean the compound, help the gardeners with the gardening. I mean, I did a lot of different things. I had a paper route close to where I was. So I had a lot of part-time jobs when I was a kid. My parents made sure that I understood the value of money and the value of working hard for something.
And getting that money, you know, your own money, it's such a great feeling when you're young. You know, it's yours for you to spend or save it and do what you will with it. So it's a great night. It's a nice feeling. And all of those are sort of building blocks, little building blocks to when you go out and work professionally in the world. But it's also building life skills, isn't it? And confidence as well, self-esteem. So yeah, we have to do things that we're shy of or worry about a little bit or scared of a little bit, to then get the benefit of achievement, that sense of achievement when you've fulfilled it, when you've completed it. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? As much as it's about academics and education and wanting to do well, we should also be building up those life skills too. Is that what you advise parents when they come to see you?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I see a lot is that all parents want to praise every single thing a child does and wants to neglect the negativity in their life. And I say, you can't teach a child to succeed unless they learn how to fail first, because a lot of success comes from failure, and a lot of success comes from doing something that's challenging and learning who you are and how you deal with things when you are challenged. But if everything is sort of paved for you, if everything's easy, if everything is just, you know, at your fingertips, then the child doesn't learn how to overcome adversity. They don't learn how to become resilient. They don't learn how to face challenges in a way that, you know, emotionally they can be, in a way that they're not emotionally unstable with it. And so all of these kind of things are very important to learn as a child growing up, because then as an adult, you adopt those same skills.
So it seems common sense, and you're saying we're not doing that, or the carers, the parents aren't doing that, or the family members, because they've got it, we've got it better, maybe we're feeling we're more able to give, we've got more money, I don't know, we want to save them the pain or the discomfort of some of life's trials. Is that why we're giving them what they need and not letting them find it for themselves?
Well, it's a little bit of a few things, to be honest. So one of the things is exactly what you're saying. As a parent, you obviously don't want to see your child get hurt, and so because we have adopted a different mindset, we are trying to protect our kids, and because we have more awareness of mental health, we want to protect our kids from developing that when we're actually doing the opposite. But another part of it is also, if you look at Generation Y and the generations before, parents actually on average started to get married and had children later. And so obviously their patience grew shorter. And so when a child starts to feel a little bit frustrated, you know, when you're in your 20s, your early 20s or mid 20s, it's easier to work with that child versus when you get a little bit older and you're doing much more, you're you tend to be a little bit shorter. And so it's like, okay, just take this, or I'll just appease him or her because, you know, they're frustrated. So there's something to both sides of it, where one of it is, yes, the parent is trying to protect the child, but also it's a lot easier for the parents. Also, it's, you know, parents have more access to money and opportunities, and so they want to give all of that to their children because they didn't have it as children, maybe, or they just want to share the experiences. So there are a lot of reasons, but unfortunately, what ends up happening is when parents are doing that, they're actually hurting rather than helping their children.
Well, according to this article, Millennials, the Lost Generation, from the Huffington Post, this is back in November 2016, you can have the highest IQ in the world, but if you can't get your act together, you can't function, you can't find that inner resource to motivate you towards successful goals. That's what some young people are facing today, what we call millennials. We've been talking about millennials off the back of this article from the Huffington Post. The lost generation is what they're being described as. That they're saying it's 18 to 33 year olds, that generation. Higher rates of depression, stress than any generation before. A group in which many have difficulty coping with the normal stressors of life, from structuring time for work, recreation, employment, graduating from college, dealing with the emotional ups and downs of relationships, even managing minor conflicts creates stress for some millennials. We were talking yesterday on the health show about anxiety in children. That was more to do with the health ramifications and impact on the body. But yet again, rising anxiety in young children. You're seeing that, you're nodding your head, Dr. Thrive. This is a reality.
Absolutely, especially with the younger teens that I see now, as well as the older adults. I mean, the older teens are more on the leg that they're suffering from anxiety so much, and they're not able to deal with general life stress. They're so scared of feeling any kind of stress. And the problem is that, you know, that kind of fear keeps us from trying anything new. It keeps us from discovering life, from learning our own strengths and weaknesses, from challenging ourselves, from building things. And so that kind of fear of experiencing negative emotions hinders us from moving forward in life.
And I think that's what we're looking at today, is where you may feel stuck, you've got stuck, and whatever age you might be. But if we're looking at the millennials, this is in some cases, I mean, there's a lot of positivity around this generation, amazing possibilities here, the creativity, like you said, the knowledge of technology, this empathy that's there, much more aware of the world and having a conscience about others. You know, very proud of my nephew, 19, he's in South Africa at the moment, working on a, you know, voluntarily on a project in a township, and you know, he had that social conscience from a very young age. You know, lots of people do, and lots of generations have before. But if there are rises in depression in this generation, where is that, and how can we help prevent it? Now, Jane's texting to say there's a great article today about how parents, this is what we're talking about how parents should put themselves and their marriage before the children. Parents of recent generations have not done this, and we are seeing many behavioural problems as a result. Kids are not learning psychological boundaries, and this disturbs their sense of security.
You know, this is a great point, because the reality is because parents are so worried about their children and they don't think of themselves, they put their kids first, they do everything for their children and they don't do things for themselves. Children just feel that, you know, automatically the parent will always be there. And it when Jane is saying it disturbs their sense of security, it has to do with the fact that that sense of security comes from parents. Usually, more often than not, as children, we develop a sense of security, a sense of safety from our parents. And when our parents do everything for us, we always think that they're always going to be there. We think that there's going to be the safety net under us if something ever happens to us. And we forget that life doesn't work that way. And sometimes life can shift everything around.
Well, let's go to the phone lines. Hello, good morning. Oh, no, they've gone. So, yeah, if you want to get through on the lines, 04-423-1010 is the number. Yeah, now what you're talking about, you've talked about this before, Dr. Thry, the style of parenting, and looking at this article as well, it says here about helicopter parenting. So parents who overprotect their children and oversee and involve themselves in all the joys and disappointments in their children's lives, in the real world. So if a child isn't frustrated by his parents in a loving and responsible way, then not only will he not ever learn about commitment, obligation and responsibility, but also the world has the potential to them to be frustrated, to get frustrated. So challenge you in a way, take you outside your comfort zone in some way.
Right, because millennials that are raised by helicopter parents, you know, become excessively dependent on them. They are very needy. They give up very easily. They don't understand how to acquire effective coping skills that deal with frustration because their parents have protected them for such a long time. And that is definitely one of the parenting styles that affects this generation and affects how they learn to deal with a lot of the things that they go through. Also, there's this what we call polarization paralysis, is when any child is facing a problem, each parent takes an extreme side. So usually, more often than not, the stereotype is, but usually more often than not, the mother becomes the sort of the softy and wants to coddle and be emotionally there for the child, where the father takes on this more, you know, harsh role, like, no, buck up, you can do it, you know, those kind of things. And that polarization creates a lot of confusion in the child because they don't know which way to go. And more often than not, especially the younger they are, they tend to go towards what's softer and what makes them feel better in the moment rather than what's going to benefit them long term.
And this could be, you know, you could be 25 and doing this with your parents.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's a trend, you know, that starts from a very young age. And then as you get older, yes, you'll usually go to the parent that you know will help you and will save you in your time of need.
Being best friends with your kids, is it a good thing or not? Now, according to this article, children who find their best friend in their parents might have a problem. When children are so pampered and protected that they don't get to try things out and test themselves against their environment, then they have a problem growing up, making decisions and coping with stress.
A lot of the teenagers that I work with, I tell their parents, you know, it's good to be friendly with your child, but it's not good to be friends with your child, because your child eventually needs to understand that there are boundaries, not just within the family, but there are boundaries in life and there are boundaries and there are frustrations and things that they're going to have to deal with alone. And so when your parent is your absolute best friend, there also is that dependency, because those lines, as much as you think they're not blurred, they're very blurred. And so the parent becomes not only the savior, but also the best friend. And so you think that they will always be there for you, which is not in reality the case. So when a parent doesn't create some sort of friendly yet also, and what we call this parenting style is authoritative, which is, you know, you're very strict, you have, not very strict, you're structured, you have boundaries, you have limits, but at the same time, you're very empathetic, you're compassionate, you care. So it's being friendly, but not their best friend as well, because you want to get them to become independent and eventually interdependent rather than independent. rather than dependent.
I think this is really interesting. We're going to come back to this because I think most people are going to think I'm doing a great job if I'm friends with my kid, whether they're a teenager, they're in their 20s or 30s, where we're speaking to each other every day, we're involved in each other's lives, I know what they're up to and what they're doing, they tell me everything, that's fantastic, I've really done well as a parent, as opposed to the kid who doesn't want to speak to the parent. I'm talking about, you know, late teens, 20s, or, you know, I want to get on and build my own life, I do want to talk to my parents, but they're my parents, they don't need to know everything about what I'm doing. So I think that's a very interesting area to get that right, because I would say it's a great thing if you've got a brilliant relationship with your kid, with your child. However, what does that really mean, and how, like you say, are they really depending on you as opposed to being independent? But let's go to the phone lines now. We've got Sue on the line. Good morning to you. Hello. Oh, we've got a bit of a problem with the lines today. Just a sec. Hello, good morning. We're through to Sue?
Yes.
Hello. Hi there. Hi, Sue. Now tell me, what did you want to share with us today?
Well, for me, I actually believe very strongly that the more you have the luxury of sitting and thinking about life, the more that depression tends to raise its ugly head. Where in societies like third world societies, I've spent quite a bit of time in Nepal, for example, and there are huge stresses in people's lives in terms of having enough food to eat, clean water to drink, you know, things that in the West we take very much for granted. Children learn about those stresses and how to cope with it, the resilience of it, very early on. Whereas in the West, not so much. We don't have to worry about food on the table in general and clean water to drink and sanitation and all of those things. And I think that that difference is huge. And I mean, there's a lot of psychological studies that, that seem to indicate the same thing.
I think that's a really interesting point. It's a really interesting point. Almost that, you know, if we're talking about resilience, you're absolutely right. There are children in the world that are so resilient because they've got to be. They get on with it. They're independent. They do what's necessary. They're not lazy. They're not waiting around, you know, expecting everything to be done for them. They have to get up and get out there and, you know, whether it's bringing water in or food or just looking for to better their lives. So is that something you would agree with, Dr. Thurair? Is depression is that a symptom of lifestyle, of a luxury lifestyle?
Well, you know, I don't think I could agree to bring it down to just that. Absolutely not. Just because also we know that it is genetic and there are biological factors. Yeah. But definitely I could say that it is a contributing factor. Because just like Sue's saying, you know, when it comes to third world countries, they don't have time to think of what they don't have because they really have to struggle and work through everything. And they have to be considerate of you know, the basic things that we forget are so important, like shelter, food, water, security, safety, those kind of things. And so they focus so much more on that. And for the longest time, they are sort of exposed to constant negative emotions and constant negativity around them because of their environment, that they have to just sort of go with it and move forward, and they can't just give up. And so that kind of
far more present.
Absolutely.
Present.
Yes.
And it's not that, what haven't I got? What happened yesterday? I'm bothered about that. What am I going to do tomorrow? What's my future? It's about being so present in the moment. And that takes away the possibilities of those emotional issues. Really good point, Sue. And for you, your circumstances.
Okay. I'm a lifelong sufferer of depression. So I can, having been brought up in the West myself, and actually not had to worry about shelter, food, water, but still having been brought up as a baby boomer in a time where I was expected to do chores around the house, unpaid, work in my parents' business for basically pocket money. But actually, I had responsibilities and obligations from an early age. That didn't save me from depression at all. But that is something that I've noticed with the difference between Western lifestyles and poor economically poor countries.
Go on, Sue.
I was just going to say, I do have two sons who are millennials. They are successful. They don't suffer from depression, either of them. They are empathic, independent young men who I enjoy spending time with, but I'm certainly not their best friend.
And when we're saying and looking at this sort of rise in depression in millennials, where do you think that is truly stemming from then? We've talked about a few things already this morning. We're going to talk about more, but where do you truly think that's stemming from then?
Well, I actually think it is stemming from having a surfeit of luxury in terms of the entire world. I mean, when you look at economically how much money you have to be in the wealthiest 50% in the world, that is a very small amount. I think it's something like 12,000 dirhams. Now, for most expats, Western expats here in Dubai, we would think, oh, that's nothing, right? Or if I only had 12,000 dirhams in my bank account, I'd be really worried about that. That puts us in a very different position to how people generally are. So when young millennials, particularly Western millennials, there are huge pressures on them to get a good job. Having one degree isn't enough. You know, people are looking for a master's or a PhD. It's not enough that you get, you know, one job. It's got to be the best job. And there's huge pressures upon young people now that, as a professional, I didn't feel the same when I was their age setting out.
Really good point, Sue. Thank you very much for the call today. Really interesting indeed. And I think it is interesting, isn't it? Back, you know, there was the time where people were, you know, happy to be working and have employment and go and do a job. Now it's about a career. It's always about, you know, I mean, I think media, yeah, from the West, media and fashion, it's like, and a lot of young people are going, and I've seen it with friends, kids, and with my niece and nephew, you know, sort of hanging on big ideas just because that's what they think they should be doing, because that's what's around them, rather than the idea of actually, you know, it's great to have an income and there's a lot in your life that you can be happy about. So it's difficult, isn't it? I think there's big challenges for young people today.
I think one of the things, sorry, Sue, to interrupt you, but I think one of the things that's really important that Sue had mentioned was the idea that, you know, now there's that degree change as well. So a lot of the millennials before, I mean, at least the generations before, if they graduated even with a high school degree,
yeah,
or even a bachelor's degree, it was enough. It was even more than enough. It was such a great achievement. Whereas now people say, oh, you just have a bachelor's, like it's not even taken seriously anymore, which, yeah, is sad, because, you know, it takes a lot to get through a bachelor's as well. And so a lot of these things, this competition, the way the world is changing, the economic changes, all of those things are affecting millennials, which makes, you know, them more likely to fall into things like depression or anxiety or even feel stressed.
Sue, thanks so much for the call today. Have yourself a great, stay tuned, keep listening to the show.
Thanks very much. Good luck with the discussion.
Thank you very much. Take care. And when we come back, we'll pick up the discussion even further. Interesting response to this today. So why is it, do you think, that there is an increase? In fact, the highest rates of depression for millennials, that sort of 20 to 35 generation, it's been called the lost generation by many. Why is that? Why do you think that's the case? We're exploring lots of possibilities with this. We were just talking then about, you know, job expectation and, you know, my parents' generation, my generation, really, in the UK, depending. Yes, you know, it was, I think I was the first in my family actually to go to university and get a degree. And that's great. I had that opportunity to do that. But, you know, for many, it was also people very happy, as long as they had a job, to go and enjoy their job, to get job satisfaction. But it didn't have to be a high-flying career or this idea of being an entrepreneur. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that or having aspirations or ambitions for that. Of course not. But it is about saying, you know, are we all sort of chasing a dream that actually may not bring us happiness. It's about knowing ourselves and knowing who we really are and what our true value system is to feel fulfilled and happy if we're looking at millennials that are suffering from stress and depression.
That also ties into what you had said before, Suzanne, which was really on point. It was just perfect. And the idea of being mindful and being present. And when you're thinking of your career and your life and where it's going, you're so worried about the next best thing. And you're always considering, what else should I do? What else should I get? What can I get? What more and more and more? Rather than being present in the moment, present with what you have, and considering that this is exactly where you need to be right now, and appreciating that. And that, I feel, a lot of millennials have difficulty with, because they're always looking for, what do I do next? And where, and they have this pressure that they have to keep doing so many things, that their passion has to be their profession, rather than their passion can be in their life, but not necessarily as part of their profession.
And maybe, is there too much choice? I don't know if that's a good thing to say. You know, is there really ever a situation that's bad if there's more too much choice? It's good to have choice. It's a sign of freedom, you know, to have choice. But is it confusing for people if there is more, we have more things, we have more money, maybe we have more choices, and yet there's higher rates of depression and stress? So why is that? Why is that not working out? Why is that not marrying up? People are texting in with their thoughts on this. Tuba says, social comparison has got to be the toughest obstacle to overcome as a millennial. Social media and other channels make this 100 times more difficult, because there's no way to avoid everyone else's successes and end up feeling worthless and unsuccessful. It goes on to say, everyone is trying so hard to be successful, especially with the economic, political, social, environmental changes. The safe future that millennials are trying to secure is guaranteed to change, and we have no control over that. So again, that sort of, you know, chasing or striving for something that's ever changing and ever moving. So are you ever going to be satisfied?
And are you ever going to be good enough? And I think that, you know, will hit a lot of core belief systems for a lot of these millennials, and that can lead to some really negative thought processes for them, which can lead to depression, could lead to increased stress and anxiety, because they're constantly thinking that they have to do more, they have to be better. Especially, you know, like Tubo was saying here, that social comparison, when you're looking at social media and everybody's just putting in those perfect highlights of what they're doing and where they're going, and, you know, throw back to this and throw back to that. And so what ends up happening is people are like, well, I'm not doing enough, I have to keep doing more. And that pressure to do more and be more could be very exhausting.
We're talking today about the millennials, that generation 18 to 33, 20 to 35, off the back of this report from the Huffington Post. The highest rates of depression and stress, suffering from stress, of this generation than ever before. Now, yes, it may be that there's more awareness. It may be that we have access to better care, or not, as the case may be. But what other reasons are there? We've been looking at parenting styles, being maybe too protective, giving too much to children, maybe even becoming the child's best friend. And this is into teens, into their 20s. And that definition of being a best friend, what does that really mean? And is it always helpful? What happens when the parent's not around anymore? How resourceful is that young person going to be? So many of you are texting in on this. We're going to get to your messages in a minute. I just wanted to share this with you. This is coming out of the UK, and broadcaster Tim Webster, he's got a 25-year-old son. Now, broadcaster Tim Webster, he is a television presenter, and he revealed that his 25-year-old son still lives at home and says he often looks after things for him, meaning things like, you know, I've been known to pay for some of his bills, some of his, you know, expenses, living expenses, fines, even road tolls. I have been known to pay for his road tolls. He's going, talking here on Channel 7 Sunrise, speaking about this situation, and talking about what he describes, or they describe, as adult school, which teaches Generation Y life skills, including folding the washing and cooking meals. Do you have one of those in your house that needs to go to adult school? So and this is really, in essence, what we're talking about is into your late teens, into your 20s, even into your 30s, maybe even into your 50s, you're still growing up. But we really look at those years of sort of latter teens into the 20s, where you're becoming an adult. And part of that definition is standing on your own two feet. What we're seeing is more and more millennials are staying at home. They're not not leaving home. They are finding it difficult to get jobs. They're finding it hard to buy a house, to buy property, to gain that independence. But they're also getting incredibly cozy and comfortable staying at home. And then you've got alongside that parents that are really helping them maybe too much, you know, paying for so many things for them. There's one family that still go on holiday together where the parents are paying for their kids. The kids are in their 20s. You know, I mean, it's a lovely thing to be able to do, but is it really doing them any favours if they're not able to stand on their own two feet and they're just falling back into the coziness of the family home? So this is what we're looking at. And we got this text message from George saying, what a great discussion. I feel people are over ambitious and a little bit unrealistic with life. How well to do the families are, they need to teach the hardships of life. Tomorrow for their most loved child, their life can take any deviation. The question is, are they prepared? Are schools being part of this awareness? So it ties in very nicely, George, your thoughts with this article, really. So something like adult school, or even before that, in regular school, are some of these life skills, should they be taught there? And hardship, it's a difficult one, isn't it? A bit of hardship for your child. Do you think that's a good thing? And how do you step back, move out the way, and watch them, observe them dealing with their own hardships in life? Or should you be stepping in and solving that problem for them? So this is what we're talking about. So keep your messages coming in. So how much are you seeing this in practice at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, Dr. Thry, where you might see someone in their 20s suffering from depression, and where that, and we're not talking necessarily about clinical depression, or maybe it is clinical depression, but where you can see this kind of marrying up of some of these ideas?
Well, quite a bit, actually, Suzanne. And you remember last week when we were talking about soft skills, and somebody had messaged in and saying, you know, well, that's not the school's job, it's the parents' job, you know. And it's interesting because now when you think about it, the school has technically become the parent nowadays, because back then it was the parent in the village that was raising the child, and the child was part of the family life. They were doing chores when they came home from school, so the school didn't have to teach them these things. But nowadays the parents are at work and they're working hard. And so the schools are pretty much where most of the children are learning all of their skills, including soft skills. So what George is talking about in terms of schools preparing them, I think it's absolutely important for kids to learn to do their own laundry, learn to cook, learn to clean up after themselves, learn to do simple house chores, that so that they can learn to live alone when they do live alone. And one of the things that you had said before, this adult school, I mean, that's absolutely accurate in the sense that, you know, there are a lot of adults and there are a lot of, you know, a lot of people that I work with where, you know, they'll say things like, well, I don't know how to cook, so I just order in every day. And then they're having difficulty with their health, which contributes also to their depression or their anxiety as well. So it's just, it perpetuates itself.
As a parent, I mean, I wonder what parents think about that. The idea, can your kids cook? Could they? You know, if you're not there, could they make themselves a meal, you know, a basic meal? Could they look after themselves if you weren't there? Because actually you're doing them a massive misservice, really, that, you know, particularly for the boys. I think, you know, you should be able to know how to cook the basics, you know, a bowl of pasta, some tomato sauce, you know, be able to put that together, scrambled eggs on toast. And it sounds like, of course we can cook that, but it's showing up time and time again that actually a lot of young people don't know how to cook a basic meal for themselves.
Right. And not just the basic meal, also laundry. They don't know how to do their laundry. You know, their whites come out pink because they put all the colors together.
If they even get that far. Right,
exactly. And they don't know how to turn it on. They don't know where to put the soap. I mean, it sounds funny to us, but these are things that could be very stressful on a transition between high school to university, or even university to living alone or moving out of your house.
And doing a job.
Exactly. Yeah. And doing a job and having to juggle between, you know, work life and home life and taking care of myself and making sure I'm fed properly, getting my laundry done, all of those things. So balancing all of those things together could be quite stressful and scary for individuals that are not prepared for it. And so a lot of the Generation Y wasn't. They were sort of not spoiled in the sense that, you know, they were given everything, but they were protected so much because we learned so much about mental health that it turned into, let's protect them from everything. And we really hurt them rather than help them become the generation that's now confused and lost.
That's what it is. This is apparently what it is. Now, looking here at young adults, do they really have it harder today? And this is being compared with 2012 versus 1984. So it's a few years ago. This is in the Globe and Mail. And it looks at all young adults who think they're getting a raw deal in today's economy. Let me tell you about how it was back in my day. In 1984, my final undergraduate year of university, tuition costs more or less were $1,000. I earned that much in a summer without breaking a sweat. When I went looking for a new car in 1986, the average cost was roughly half of what it is now. It was totally affordable. The average price of a house in, this is in Canada, Toronto, back in 1984 was just over $96,000. I wasn't buying just then, but it's worth noting that the average family after tax income back then was close to $50,000. Buy a first home? Easy to imagine for new graduates of the day. I had it easier than today's 20-somethings, and I have no problem saying so. But quite a few others can't see what all the fuss is about when it comes to the financial concerns of today's young adults. This becomes clear, and more people I talk to, and some are quite heartfelt, like the one from a 78-year-old gentleman who said he grew up in abject poverty on a farm and worked to pay for his education. But other comments reflected a view that today's young adults just should just grow up. My sense is that's what they're trying to do, but it's tougher out there than some of us might realise. After earning a 3-year BA, Bachelor of Arts, and majoring in political science at York University in Toronto back in 1984, I landed a summer job as a copy editor at the Canadian Press, the National Wire Service. I earned enough to spend a year in Ottawa earning a Bachelor of Journalism degree at university. I had to work through the holidays to top up my savings, but I was financially self-sufficient and I incurred zero debt. Today, financial self-sufficiency, it's impossible without taking breaks from school to work and, you know, without incurring loans, debts, and all of that goes with it. Same with trying to buy a house. So it's a really interesting read, and it makes you wonder and it makes you think how challenging it is for young people today to have that independence when they've got financial concerns, work security concerns, and getting on the property ladder is a huge issue for many people.
Especially with the economic sort of recession that we've had. I mean, you know, going back to previous generations, there were a lot more opportunities, and that has to do with, you know, less population, more growth in different fields and industries around the world. So at that time, when you worked hard, you could get a great opportunity because there were so many. But now, with this oversaturation in every market and every industry, it's really hard for a lot of these millennials to find a job to help sustain them moving forward in life, as well as to pay off the debts that they've been having to succumb to because of the fact that they wanted to get the better degree so they can be and have a more competitive edge when it comes to the market itself. So it's very sort of, they're being pulled and tugged in different directions, and that's where all that confusion comes into play. It's not that they're lazy, it's just that they're so confused, they don't know which way to go.
Some might be.
I mean, there are no absolutes.
What do you think? Is it harder for the millennial generation? Is it harder for them today than it was for your generation? Paula says, if they're tech savvy enough to operate a smartphone, they're savvy enough to operate a washing machine and sort the colours. Not sure about that, Paula. And also, millennial Google everything. Why don't they just Google how to cook, you know, and how to do laundry? I was never really taught to cook. I just got a recipe book and I got on with it. You'd have thought, wouldn't you? You might put those two things together. So why aren't they? Why is that not happening? Interesting, isn't it? One here, my 20-year-old son has depression and anxiety and has almost zero independent living skills. How can I stay positive and help him? Where is the hope? I've tried to stay positive. I've spent a lot of money on counselling and different things. There doesn't seem much improvement on his condition. I feel exhausted and depressed. I know that me being depressed is not good for my son.
You know, depression is quite difficult because it encompasses so many different aspects of a person's life, and there's not usually one source to the depression. There are many things, and unfortunately, with depression, sometimes you have to look at many different factors. So there is that genetic factor because it is in the family as well as a biological factor as well. But it's how they look at themselves, and a lot of that comes from achievements and lack of feeling like you have the ability to achieve. And the ability to get through the tough and the hardships in life. So exposing people to different things and having them feel that achievement usually helps a lot with depression. One of the things that I do a lot with my clients that suffer from depression is I tell them, recognize your achievements and keep a log on a daily basis. Show yourself that you do accomplish things on a day-to-day basis. And don't compare. Don't compare yourself to other people. Don't look at it and say, oh, getting up in the morning is not that big of a deal. Everybody does it. And I say, no, but for a person who suffers with depression, getting up in the morning, getting out of bed, getting dressed, getting showered, and going to work is a massive achievement. And so recognizing all of the good qualities in that person can be extremely helpful to boosting that self-confidence. You know, a lot of individuals try to boost self-confidence first in order to help them through depression. And I say you can't build confidence without taking necessary steps. And so those steps have to do with recognizing all the things that you do and recognizing how to move forward. And at times, you just have to be patient with a person and their process, because especially with depression, it can set you back sometimes. And so don't push. It's important not to push people out of their depression. Let them, you know, work through it and find the best way. Because if you push them too hard and then they fall back, that could be even worse for them than not moving forward to begin with.
It's challenging anyway, but very difficult for a parent to see their 20-year-old son at home and going through something like this, and you know, trying different counselling and different strategies, and obviously affecting their mental health as well. Again, it's that idea, isn't it, that, well, you know, other 20-year-olds might be going off to university, or maybe they've started their first job, and my son isn't. My son's stuck. My son's at home, not able to get up in the morning. And so, you know, it is a difficult thing. So if you've already gone through counselling and it's not working, what do you do?
Well, sometimes if you go through counseling, it's not that the counseling didn't work, but maybe the methodology of the counselor didn't work. Because the reality is that there are so many different avenues in psychology and so many different styles and strategies. So it's important to try to find the one that fits you. Most people will run and jump into CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, because it's the quickest. But the reality is that sometimes it's good to really look at different areas and at different kind of strategies. And you know, not giving up just because one thing didn't work, because pushing at depression, because it pushes back so much and it resists so much, pushing back at depression can be helpful when you just keep trying rather than, you know, just giving up.
Mm. And again, that, you know, that is hard, but to that pressure that having to follow suit what everybody else is doing, and that's all part of what we're sort of up against as well. I think we've always been up against that, but even more so with social media and the perceptions. We seem to be more aware of each other than ever before. So trying to kind of feel that you don't have to go with what everybody else is doing, and that's hard for young people to deal with. You know, what happens when you don't get the grades and all your friends are going off to university and you're staying behind? You know, how do you deal with that? How do you work through that?
Especially with social media. I mean, that's such a good point, because a lot of people, they'll post things that are great about their life. They won't post that, you know, today I had a bad day, or today something, you know, horrible happened. Most people, what'll end up happening is that you'll see this massive feed of positivity and happiness and highlights of perfection, perfect family, perfect job, perfect, you know, university, perfect life. And so when you are suffering from depression, that could actually set you back even more, because you keep thinking to yourself, why am I not good enough to have that? Why don't I deserve to have that? And it becomes part of what you say to yourself, that I don't actually deserve that, and I am not worthy of that, and I'm not good enough to have that. And that just brings the depression more and more down. And I think for millennials, that can be quite horrible for them, because of the fact that they have this social pressure, because they see it all the time. And actually, there's a study in 2014 that was done that showed that the millennial generation, that is exposed to more than two social media accounts on a day-to-day basis suffer from more depression and more anxiety than those that have zero to two social media accounts. So you can see that the social media does affect a person because they're constantly comparing themselves to everybody around them rather than looking within and being present and mindful in the moment.
Yeah, that big present and mindful in the moment and also real. So I think that, you know, so much now people are living their lives through the screen that it might be real, but it's not in, you're not, it's not there in front, really in front of you. So there's a sort of already a slight disconnect, and without even knowing it, you're measuring everything, and you feel like you're interacting, and you feel like you're involved, and you feel like you've got lots of friends, or you feel, but actually you're not really really living, are you? Are you really living when everything's through a phone or through a screen? You know, even though you're interacting and talking to people and you're watching things and you have an opinion on things, but is it true if you're not physically there doing those things?
One of the things that's interesting is that you'll hear people give, you know, advantages and disadvantages of something like that, because especially for those that are very introverted or have social anxiety, something like that could benefit them. But more often than not, what you'll notice is that individuals will hide behind a screen, will say things that they would never necessarily say to a person in their face, would judge people much more because they're anonymous. So the social media aspect to it not only portrays this fake life of every individual that's around you, but also it portrays this idea that, you know, that you have now the right to judge it because it's public. And I think something that's really important that you had mentioned, Suzanne, is the idea of disconnect. And, you know, a lot of my clients, when I tell them to write things down, they'll write it on their phone and then they bring it in the next week. And I say, no, I don't want to see it. I need you to write it. Use your hands. And the reason for that is because there are a lot of studies that show that when we type things on our phone, we don't actually connect to the words and we don't allow the words to connect to us. But when we use our hands like pen and paper and just write things down, we're able to connect to what we are writing and allow it to affect us and influence us in better ways rather than just typing it on a phone.
And it must be similar if you're actually in the room with somebody, standing in front of somebody, talking to them and looking at them in the eyes. You're going to be more present. It's going to be more real. It's going to be more impactful. You're going to be more connected.
Of course. You know, even on a basic level, when I do my therapy sessions, it's always more beneficial for them to come into my office and to see me. I mean, sometimes if I travel and I have to see some clients on Skype, they will even tell me that, you know, I don't like this session. It didn't feel real to me. It didn't feel genuine to me. It felt awkward. And I'll tell them, you know, that's fair. I mean, this is very different. So they prefer the face-to-face, the direct contact, because for them there's a lot more meaning to it, and there's a lot of nonverbal language that you're reading from the other person, as well as you feel a sense of connectivity to the other person. It feels like a social interaction rather than a technological interaction.
Well, this ties in with this article about millennials and being lonely, and it looks like that's also on the increase as well. I wouldn't expect that. I wouldn't have thought that, but according to this, and there's lots of studies involved, and the general survey found that the number of Americans with no close friends has tripled since 1985. Zero is the most common number of confidants reported by almost a quarter of those surveyed. Likewise, the average number of people Americans feel they can talk to about important matters has fallen from 3 to 2. It appears more prevalent among millennials, and there are various reasons for this. So exploring loneliness, but one of the things that came up out of this is that this millennial loneliness is the internet, because it makes it viral. So it's not a coincidence that loneliness begins to surge. Sorry, let me start that again. It's not a coincidence that loneliness began to surge after Apple launched its first commercial personal computer, and 5 years before Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web. Use of the internet to alleviate loneliness can work for some people, like you were saying, people that are very sensitive, very introverted. But on the whole, social connection no longer requires that face-to-face or getting in a car and going to see somebody or picking up a telephone. It doesn't, where you need to plan it, where you need to think about it, where it's measured. It's just a click of a finger. And that isn't necessarily fulfilling what a human being needs. And hence why you're getting this sense of isolation or loneliness. That's according to these studies. It also goes on to talk about mirroring and how it spreads. So isolation and social isolation can actually be something that grows as people are aware of it. Does that make sense?
It does. And actually, that whole thing that you were mentioning actually boils down to one big word, which is investment. Being invested in all of these things. So when you're online or when you're on the phone and you're chatting with friends or you're even Skyping with friends or anything like that, you're not putting in that much effort in order to make that connection work. But when you get out of the house, like you said, get into the car, drive around, make a plan, you know, physically get ready, all of those things, you are investing so much into that friendship, into that relationship, into that encounter. So when you meet, there is more meaning to it because there's a lot more investment in it. And so what happens with millennials is that they're so used to not doing that now. It becomes so part of who they are, part of their day-to-day, is that it's just easier to make a phone call. It's easier to send a WhatsApp message. It's easier to do this. It's easier to do that rather than invest in the actual act of arranging for something to happen. And so the lack of fighting for that difficult, that going through that, you can call it a hardship, but it's that inconvenience,
effort.
If you will.
It's
that
putting the effort in.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And making the, like you said, making the effort, you know, of actually doing something for yourself that goes beyond what's right in front of you. That is where a lot of millennials are having difficulty. And that's where they struggle with things like depression and anxiety and stress, is because they're just so used to having things around them and with such ease. So they don't have the sense of accomplishment, the sense of achievement constantly, because they're always going for the easy way out.
And it's that payback, isn't it? When you've put effort in, you get the payback, you feel that sense of satisfaction, that sense of fulfillment. It was worth it. There was a payoff to it, rather than it being something you want instantly, quick, and then the next thing and the next thing. You never really fully enjoy or appreciate that moment. Oh, well, we've got lots of positive things to talk about as well when it comes to being a millennial as well. And if you are one, let me know your thoughts on what we've been talking about today. We've been taking a look at millennials and the issues they may be facing today. It is the generation that has suffered more anxiety and depression, who seem to find it difficult to cope with stress. Maybe they have more to be stressed about than previous generations. What do you think? Let me know on those numbers. And looking at the United States and this article about millennials, shocking statistics about real millennial problems and how we overcome. Most people think millennial problems are over exaggerated and a product of the entitled millennial hipster archetype we've created. Yet the millennial generation is facing insane challenges unlike generations before that. Most people don't fully understand the implication of these real millennial problems. Just looking in the America, and this person was exploring media and the different outlets and how they perceived millennials. And so pitching over 60 media outlets about my new book, All Grown Up, Searching for Self, Faith, and a Freaking Job is what it's called, and telling them that the story of what our generation is really having to go through. Now, some media members totally understand the challenges facing us, having seen it firsthand themselves. Others, though, a slight majority of media who shot back with the same old tired stereotypes about our generation, calling us entitled, lazy, that we're millennials, we're given trophies for just existing. So that's what we've been facing, according to this millennial, but goes on to talk about things like the millennial generation has experienced real challenges, many of them at levels unparalleled to what Gen X and boomers experienced. Things like education. So the most educated generation to date when it comes to university education, and yet where do they go for work? Jobs are it's really difficult and really challenging. Economics, and a lot of upset after the political situation changing in America, that's affecting millennials apparently. Looking here, millennial problem, 40% of unemployed workers are millennials. US census data put this out. That was a stat from the PEW research. The first in modern era to have higher levels of student loan debt, poverty and unemployment, and lower levels of wealth and personal income than any other generation at the same stage of life. I'm really surprised at that, but it's coming from a reliable source. So very interesting to note.
Yeah, there are a lot of, stereotypical misconceptions around millennials and, you know, the fact that they're so entitled or they're self-absorbed and those kind of things. But we forget that, you know, just as they're a different generation, the whole world is a different generation. The whole world is a different environment than it ever was before. So we have to consider all different aspects before we just are quick to judge who they are and why they do what they do.
Mm. You start to see why they might be staying at home longer with the parents. But yeah, at the same time, balancing that out to give them the resources to manage and cope. It's these, a lot of what the research is talking about is they seem less able to cope with stressful situations, with, you know, life's hard knocks, when things don't go the way they want them to go. They struggle with that because they've had, maybe they've had this coziness. It's been what they've been described in one article as, it's been warm and it's loveliness. But actually life isn't always like that, and you need to be able to step up, grow up and deal with it. But there are some challenges. So let's look at some of the stereotypes then around millennials.
So basically a lot of people, like you've heard right now, say that they're entitled, you know, that they're entitled, they expect fast promotion, they're unable to or unwilling to pay their dues like the rest of us do.
Why would I work for that? I'm not going to work for that.
Right.
And why should I?
And what that portrays itself as from a millennial is usually very confident in their ability, especially regarding technology, because they're, you know, it's their generation, that technological generation. But what actually research shows is that millennials mean it, that they want a meaningful and important job that gives them a sense of purpose and also have a positive impact on society. So it's not that they are actually feeling entitled, they just want to portray whatever they can and give more and give back because they want more meaning than just I have a job or I have a career. So that one is very important for a lot of millennials. Also, you know, we were talking about this, that they're overly connected to their parents. And so for older generations, they look at it as that, oh, they're being coddled, they're you know, they're spoiled, they can't work alone. But how millennials are actually meaning it is that they feel family oriented because they're feeling so lonely, they're so scared to disconnect because they want to remain connected to something and someone. And because everybody around them is so connected to technology and everything else, they want to hold on to their parents because that's the only real connection that they have currently. So that is a very big struggle for them as well. Another thing that a lot of millennials, and I have to admit that I am guilty of this one, that I feel that a lot of millennials, especially a lot of the students that I see, can be quite narcissistic, is because they're constantly, you know, self-obsessed, taking selfies. And I always yell at them if they take selfies in my class. I tell them no selfies in my class. And I look at it as, oh my God, they're so self-obsessed. But what they're actually doing is promoting themselves. And for that reason is because, you know, Instagram, Facebook, all of these things nowadays are used to promote yourself, even in a job interview. And ironically, I actually check when somebody emails me, you know, their CV, I look online, their online profile. And so it's not that they're so self-obsessed and narcissistic, but sometimes they've learned that technology can be used to promote themselves. And so that what they're doing is actually using a new tool in a good way. But because, you know, a lot of us don't understand that factor, we tend to judge it really quickly and we forget that this is actually a good tool for them.
Okay, any others there?
Well, the last one is that constant need for feedback. And I think this is a really big one.
That constant need for feedback right now.
Right, absolutely. That instant gratification.
And you haven't replied to me, that message I sent 4 minutes ago.
Right, right. And especially in a job, it's that, you know, I did this. Where's my good job? Or why didn't, you know, where's my, you know, pat on the back? Like, why aren't you saying something back to me? And most employers will look at it as, oh my God, they're so needy, they're so attention seekers, they always want to be praised for everything. And it really irritates supervisors, to be honest. But what millennials actually mean is that they're eager to please. They just want to know, they want to know that you think they're doing a good job, and they're looking for that mentorship because they're trying to grow on a social level as well as on a humanity level. So for them, it's so interesting how perspective can change depending on, and it could mean something completely different. You're thinking of which side you're on, either the receiving end or sort of the giving end, in terms of that actual trait itself.
A lot of articles are saying that millennials are much more open-minded, much more liberal when it comes to rights across gender and in the workplace as well. A couple of people have texted in about entrepreneurs and being entrepreneurial. One person here said the problem is that in the last decade you have focused so much on producing executives rather than entrepreneurs. I don't know if that's the case, whether people would argued the other way round. And Tuba's saying, you know, that to understand romantic or platonic relationships are hard to come by, too, because of the familial parental relationships are even more important. So where you're putting your... So this is jumping into this scenario where you think your father or your mother is your best friend, and it's actually stopping you from building relationships with other people of your own age outside of the family. And, you know, whether, and some might say, well, why do you have to do that? If you've got a great relationship with your father or your mother, they're your best friend, maybe you go out together, maybe you travel together, maybe you sit and have long discussions around the house, that's got to be a good thing, isn't it? It's great to have that relationship. But if it's to the point where you're not building relationships with other people of your own age, that could be an issue down the line. I don't know. Could it be?
Of course it can be. I mean, I know this sounds very morbid, but the reality is that your parents aren't going to be alive for as long as you are alive. So you have to create other relationships. I mean, it's always good to have a great relationship with your family members and your parents, but ultimately they're not the end all. I mean, you have to build a good support network for yourself in, you know, considering people that are more closer to your age, life experiences, sort of things that you're going through, because ultimately, you know, your parents won't always be there. And it's important for you to learn those life skills, because if you are stuck to family, then you are doing what's comfortable because you're too scared to try something new, to challenge yourself, to learn those soft skills, to create new friendships. And it can be extremely scary, and it is very anxiety provoking. But the reality is that sometimes we have to go through the negative to get to the positive.
So communicating with your millennial, here's an example of that. My son, the millennial, in 2013, my son made the transition from a senior leaving high school to a freshman entering college. He left wide-eyed but bushy-tailed and ready for the world. I secretly drifted into a somber state of being and silently cried. Our words were separating in the physical sense for the first time, our worlds were, and I was concerned. My concerns were about the external environment and all it had to offer a young millennial, both good and bad. Therefore, I sat him down for about an hour and reiterated the importance of him maintaining his morals, values, and overall comfort within himself while on this ever so important journey. Additionally, and more importantly, I reminded him to keep an informed and keep us informed when he was travelling. He listened, I thought, and off he went. The first semester went well, no large or minor hiccups. One day the following spring, I called to catch up and he answered, which was very unusual. How has your day been so far? I curiously asked. And he responded, awesome. I'm in the VIP box at a Major League Baseball game. Immediately, I knew he was not in a university and figured he was either in a different state or a different city. Whichever it was, didn't matter. He was not located where he was supposed to be. That's the same state and different city. Instead of reprimanding him, though, long drawn out dialogue, etc., I remained calm, created a short job aid using the memo app on my smartphone and sent it to him via text. The job aid was fitted with keywords outlining the do's and don'ts of travelling while away from home. He was so receptive, I began to use the same approach on many topics, and he began to find the information favourable, absorb it, and act in accordance. I learned that millennials tend to prefer practical spurts of data delivered in a tech-savvy format. Millennials choose to learn it in new and different ways. For them, formal learning doesn't contribute much to substantial retention, and they expect more informal, just-in-time learning sources to acquire and assimilate knowledge. So she's quite academic, this mum, when it comes to, but she's figuring out how to communicate best with her millennial son. My son is a good example of this analogy. If I'd given a long drawn-out speech like initially, he would have been less receptive again. Providing short blasts of information in a text coupled with a non-authoritative approach assisted in him becoming receptive. That's great, I would say. Why did you need to know exactly where he was and what state he was in at his age, really? Why can't he's away at university? Why does he need to tell his mum where he is every minute of the day? What do you think? Renette, who says having hobbies is very important, no time for negative thoughts. When we're talking about millennials, you want them to be happy, you want them to feel fulfilled, and yet they're the generation with higher statistics of anxiety, severity of depression, and it seems not able to manage quite so well with stress, not having those coping mechanisms. And we've been exploring why that is and where that's coming from. Now, as the discussion has evolved, there's also how it is that in creating this great relationship with your children as they grow up into young adults, and you know, maybe you're even best friends with them, and that might work well, and if you're happy, that's great, but it's about preparing them for the future and being able to stand on their own two feet. So if they get stuck, if they're feeling stuck, then how do you enable them correctly, or how do they, you know, launch, as we were talking about earlier, that failure to launch, so launch effectively in their life. But also where it's about that, almost like a role reversal, how is it the case that you will find today in some households it is the children, i.e. the 22, I think I've got a comment here, the terrible 22s as opposed to the terrible twos, where they are the ones dictating, or maybe it happens with teenagers as well, they're the ones dictating to the parents how things are going to be. So down to what we're going to eat tonight, where we're going at the weekend, what holiday we're all going to go on that you're going to be paying for. How is it that parents are allowing that, or they feel comfortable and happy with that?
You know, that flabbergasts me, to be honest, because the reality is that I always tell parents that you need to have boundaries, you need to set boundaries and limitations. Even if you want to be friendly and empathetic and compassionate with your children, you want to have a great relationship with them, you can. Just don't let go of those limits and boundaries, because children need to learn that, especially as adults. When they walk into a job and their boss is, you know, having a bad day, yelling and screaming at them, they can't just look at them and then say something very inappropriate back, thinking that it's appropriate to do that either, because they've been used to doing that at home, or cross boundaries at work because they've been used to doing that at home. So by blurring those boundary lines at home, you set them up to have so many negative experiences as they get older, and in different scenarios that are not just within the family. And so building limits can be, I mean, I know some people have trouble with limits because they feel that you're not allowing your child to be free and to open up and to really think outside the box. That's not the case. You're actually helping them understand that you can do all of that, but in a realistic life setting, rather than just in an openly free environment that is not reality as they move forward.
So you mentioned there about work and why millennials are struggling with mental health at work is an article here from Forbes magazine. Americans don't take mental health seriously enough. According to the NIMH, as many as 45% of mental health cases go untreated in this. These statistics are devastating and also not widely known, but they're not terribly controversial. What is controversial, or at least uncomfortable, is the idea that millennials suffer from more mental health issues than any previous generation. This challenges some of the common assertions that millennials are entitled, lazy, and lack a work ethic or respect for the dollar, for the currency. We've talked about that, but it goes on to talk about how you deal with it in the workplace because of this expectation. Because you're young, because you've got all the kit, because you've got this creativity, you're therefore going to be happy and great. But what we've been trying to highlight is that might not always be the case. Millennials report depression in higher numbers than any previous generation. So 20%, or one in five. But what does this really mean in concrete terms? What's the fallout of a situation where one in five members of an entire generation report depression symptoms? To begin with, let's dispel with the idea that depression is merely feeling sad. Depression is a recognized and recursive disease. It can be misunderstood, and it is always and often debilitating. And while it can be treated, there's not yet a cure. I think also what's interesting to note, and you can clarify this for me, Thoraya, but with regards to clinical depression, if you develop this when you're young, it is something that you might be able to manage and change. And maybe, you know, I don't know, could you recover from it completely? Whereas if you develop depression when you're, say, in your 40s and 50s, it tends to be the case that you may need to be medicated. So if you develop depression as a younger person, this might be manageable. You might be able to, if you have to have medication, you might be able to come off medication. But if you're diagnosed when you're in your 40s or 50s and you have to go onto medication, there's a tendency that you will have to remain on medication. depression for the rest of your life. Is that right or not?
Well, somewhat. So basically, when it comes to clinical depression, it doesn't really matter about with age. What matters is the severity. So the more severe the depression is, the more likely medication is used. Now, usually the rule of thumb is we try the medication for the first time for 6 months. If there is a relapse after that, we try it for a year. And then if there's a relapse after that, then the medication is used lifelong. But more often than not, with mild or moderate depression, either at young ages or older ages, that can be worked on even without medication.
And those signs, so for the millennial, for that 20-something, 30-something, where what might be indicators that all is not as well as they appear to make out?
So you would think of the acronym sort of SIGI CAPS, which is what we use for depression. So there's that depressed mood, so the saddened mood. But on top of that, you have changes in sleep, changes in interest. So you're no longer interested in the things that you used to be interested in. There's constant feeling of guilt, energy shifts as well, concentration shifts, appetite shifts, what we call psychomotor retardation or agitation, which is the idea of moving more or moving less than you used to be, and then very dark thoughts. So all of those are symptomologies. When we talk about clinical depression, there has to be at least 5 out of those 9 for an extended period of time for that to be considered clinical depression.
And we will come back to this topic. Many people have been interacting with us today on it. What's the solution? We've touched on quite a lot when it comes to how parents are with their kids, whatever their age are. We've talked a bit about how you sort of view what your aspirations are and your ambitions, about being realistic. We've talked about being more present and more connected, as in real terms, face to face with people, and a little bit of hardship. But we don't mean it in an awful way, but in a realistic way, because life isn't always, as they say, a bed of roses. So anything else that we can offer into the mix when it comes to resolving the idea that there is higher cases of depression for people for that generation?
Well, what I would say is to teach resiliency and coping mechanisms with this kind of stress, because already they're feeling them, they're suffering with depression. So we can't go back and change what's already been done. But what we can do is help them learn how to work through whatever their stresses are, and learn to understand that life isn't as logical as they thought it would be. That, you know, if I work really hard, or if I, you know, and if I have all of these degrees, then I'm going to get this high status, I'm going to get all of these accomplishments. It doesn't work that way, because the environment has changed. And so really educating millennials about the reality of life and how to work through their stressors and challenge themselves rather than always find the easy way out will help them work through their depression as well.
Yeah, I think that's what I've taken from today. The essence of this is the coping strategies, the coping mechanisms, and it seems that's the root of all of this, is not feeling able to cope, not managing stress as well as they could do. And so addressing that, keep getting to the root cause of that. Dr. Thraya Kanafani, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Suzanne.
You will find Dr. Thraya at the Human Relations Institute and Clinics in JLT. We've posted up her details as well on our social media today and our blog post. Check that out at dubaieye1038.com/DubaiToday.